pick up on some of the points that have been talked about today about the kind of entangled nature of food, and I suppose what can be done politically to ask questions about that. And I'm going to be focusing on a few examples from activist practice that have kind of tried to connect or use taste, I suppose, in political ways to try and prompt reflection and draw connections between the things we eat and the actual sort of social and cultural and political relations that lie behind processes of producing, consuming and distributing food. And I'll just talk about a few examples from that. To give a bit of context, I'm from a cultural theory background, but I'm going to try not to make it too densely theoretical, and I'm going to be focusing mostly on the examples. And just one thing I'd like to say about the theory. What I've tried, not necessarily succeeded, but what I'm trying to do in my work is bring together theories that try to think about animals in sort of non-anthropocentric ways, and bring it together with examples from activist practice to see what dialogue could be forged between the two things. And I'm particularly interested in, I suppose, forms of animal activism that try to move beyond rights frameworks. And that's because certainly in the animal studies literature, rights have been criticised for several reasons. The two key ones though being that they're criticised often for being seen as anthropocentric, and that they're often founded or seen as having histories that are bound up with quite problematic conceptions of rights as founded on sort of agency over or distance from nature, or autonomy and kind of power over nature in particular ways. And also rights are sometimes seen as quite anthropomorphising, in the sense that if you're just applying rights to other non-human animals, it suggests that things only have value if they're somehow like humans in some ways. So I'm sort of interested in forms of activism that try and craft alternatives, I suppose. And I think food's quite an interesting site for this. Before I turn to examples from activism, to give a sense of what I mean when I say I'm interested in how taste can trace some of the political and social relations that lie behind food, I wanted to just illustrate this by talking about an example from my teaching that I tried to use to draw some of those connections. This was for a cultural theory module, and it was at the end of the module, and I was trying to get students to reflect on really some of the advantages and disadvantages of some of the theories we've been talking about throughout the term. And to do this, I wanted to pick a good case study that they could apply theories to. And I thought, what's one of the most everyday examples we could talk about? McDonald's. So what we did in class was I said, right, think about Big Mac, and then try to think of all the processes, places, various types of actors, be they human or non-human, that have to be in place and lie behind something like a Big Mac. And the students kind of took up this task with relish, actually, and did some quite good work, some of which was quite inventive. So I've got a nice timeline at the top where people were trying to look at things about the history of McDonald's, how it enrolled various actors throughout its history. Some people focused in on particular ingredients and all the processes that had to be in place. Some, that's a dead cow, so some people did slightly more puerile images, but nonetheless, they come up with some quite sort of profound comments. So they did do some good work here, and I'm not trying to shame them by including this image. This, I don't really like this term in particular, but this method of using an object to trace connections in this way is called cyborg pedagogies. But what I was interested in this was I was interested in how like an object could kind of evoke all of these connections in this particular way. And it made me think about, could this process of connecting the act of eating to all of the flows and processes that lie behind that act be translated to political contexts in ways that maybe did justice to the complexity of subject matter. So why I think this is quite useful is it kind of draws together the sort of intersectional nature of food production and consumption. Certainly in class, students talked about things to do with capitalism, class, gender, and the thing they pointed out with a lot of the theories that we were using was that they tended to miss out environmental and animal questions, and that was something they all picked up on, which I thought was quite helpful. The other important thing is that it takes into account, I suppose, the material relations that lie behind all of these things. So it tries to connect these issues to do with class, gender, and the environment, and think in a very concrete way about the infrastructures that lie behind them, the spaces in which these the, you know, very entangled processes of production and consumption take place, and the scales at which they take place. So in class, students talked about everything from the sort of micromanagement of kitchen practices, the sort of assembly line production, to, I don't know, the way slaughterhouses were organised, the kind of global flows of sort of animal bodies and sort of the different forces of labour that are involved behind this. And I think these are important things to bring together if we're to sort of move beyond rights frameworks that might focus on, say, a particular actor involved in this, such as workers in kitchens or animals in slaughterhouses, and sort of do justice to the entangled nature of these relations. How then can we translate this to more activist contexts? So just to give a bit of context with a sort of example of McDonald's activism to complement the McDonald's example I was talking about. So as well as displaying my horrible fashion sense from when I was 21, this isn't fancy dress, sadly. But obviously one of the conventional ways of communicating to diverse publics is distributing pamphlets. And in a really pragmatic level, there's only so much information you can convey if you're communicating in that way. So this particular campaign was part of the long-standing international campaign against McDonald's that originated really in the 1980s when activists distributed a fact sheet that was anti-McDonald's and then got sued by McDonald's, which led to the longest running court case in British legal history. And the pamphlet still gets distributed today, partly as a sort of standing up and saying we're not going to be bullied by a corporation like this. The original intent, long before people like Karen Brad were talking about the entangled nature of, I don't know, these infrastructures, this type of pamphlet was trying to bring these issues together. And the idea behind it was that, yeah, it talked about workers' rights, it talked about environmental factors, and it showed all of these things were implicated in McDonald's as a corporation. And it wasn't just about McDonald's, it sort of talked about global food corporations in a much broader sense. The difficulty is, and I don't know if anybody's done pamphleteering before, there are several difficulties. There are conceptual difficulties, but there are also practical difficulties. If you're trying to communicate the complexity and the interrelated nature of all of these things, I think there are limitations to what you can get across on a pamphlet like that, and also the levels of engagement that you can facilitate. I mean, most people pick up a pamphlet like that and kind of chuck it away. It's not necessarily the best form of engagement. There's also another problem, I suppose, with it has to sort of necessarily fragment issues and treat them like a kind of list of here are all the different things that McDonald's is problematic because of it. It can't necessarily get across the entangled nature of things quite as well as it could do. And that makes it much easier for corporations to respond by doing similar sort of tick box activities to say, oh, well, actually, you've pointed out here that we don't support workers' rights. Well, we're introducing on-the-job qualifications, so it doesn't matter if our workers are sort of minimum wage, and you know, it doesn't. So they use sort of sticky plaster solutions to deal with problems one by one. And I think if we're not finding ways of getting across how interrelated these issues are, it can be easy to sort of for corporations to respond by sort of ticking off or making kind of solutions to individual problems without really addressing the broader infrastructural issues. And the other problem, I think, associated with communicating issues with pamphlets in this way is often, even though this pamphlet was originally produced by people coming together and having dialogue about the issues they wanted to talk about, how to formulate it, this pamphlet's been distributed since the 1980s, as I've said, and the issues have kind of congealed in a particular way since then. And actually, activists, and certainly I've found this, and I know other people have found that when they actually encountered McDonald's workers felt that they were being represented or spoken for in ways that they felt didn't actually map on to their experiences of working at McDonald's anymore. So the workers themselves were feeling quite alienated, and sort of in an inadvertent hierarchy had arisen between would-be advocates who were seen to be engaging in perhaps misguided forms of political ventriloquism that didn't necessarily represent the rights and the needs of people who they thought they were kind of trying to lobby for. And that relates to a kind of conceptual problem in animal studies, where a lot of animal activism has been treated more broadly as trying to kind of speak for non-human entities in ways that kind of inadvertently reinforce human privilege by sort of depicting humans as the privileged spokesperson, people for, I suppose, non-human agencies, etc. So there are all sorts of difficulties, I think, with trying to communicate these issues. Firstly, they're difficult to communicate, and it's difficult to kind of get across these issues to publics. But there are also kind of a whole load of conceptual problems associated with this form of advocacy. So I wanted to talk about taste as a potential alternative or kind of complement to conventional awareness-raising campaigns. And taste has been talked about by someone like Marco Carolan, who talks about this idea of embodied food politics. And over the past couple of days, the idea, the link between food and embodiment, I think, has been reiterated throughout the conference. You know, taste is seen as something that, and you associate tastes with, it was nostalgia talked about yesterday, I think. And the idea of, when you grow up, you acquire certain tastes, you sort of have certain embodied relationships with food that maybe support inadvertently certain ways of producing and consuming food, is something that Carolan sort of picks up on. And his solution is to try and foster alternative embodiments with food consumption and production that try to kind of unsettle maybe the everyday ways in which we produce food that perhaps inadvertently support the agricultural industrial complex. Now the problem, I think, arises with some of the examples that he talks about, because the examples he talks about tend to be things like organic farming, keeping kind of chickens in your backyard, etc., that aren't necessarily available to everybody in the population. Emma Rowe gives us a series of different examples of talking about how food festivals, for instance, can do a similar job in kind of what she calls punctuating the everyday and creating kind of new, more sort of sensory engagements with food that can maybe raise awareness in more effective ways than kind of giving out literature in a kind of didactic way. So there's a lot of discussion about the value of taste and the value of sort of alternative embodied engagements with food in perhaps somehow unsettling, I suppose, our assumptions about how food is produced and consumed, raising awareness in new ways. But obviously there is a class politics, as I've said, associated with this type of strategy. So Julie Guthman has pointed out, for instance, that localism is a strategy, and she's talking particularly about organic food that tries to be brought to certain communities, can be defensive, xenophobic, and impervious to uneven development, as if all communities would want to stay as they are. So this idea of kind of bringing good food to others is the name of this article, and how that can kind of almost be problematic in relating to the second definition of taste that's come up throughout this conference. So taste as being something that sort of is distinctive, that gives you kind of cultural capital in a particular way. So she's talking very much about how the taste for organic food that people are trying to kind of encourage, you know, as a way of providing an alternative model of food production and consumption, could be kind of problematically making some people feel very excluded and be a signifier of cultural capital for people who can afford these types of food, ethical capital as well. So the examples that I'm interested in try to approach this question in a slightly different way. So I've talked about the kind of three examples in my work of kind of activist food practices that do use embodied engagements with food to draw attention to I suppose the messy infrastructures that lie behind food consumption. They tried to do it in a way that maybe asks more political questions and tries to connect the act of eating, not see it as a kind of taste preference, but tries to ask questions about why is it impossible for certain people to get access to certain types of food, that I suppose tries to do things a bit more critically. And the three examples that I've looked at, the first one, I know this is an image of like a compost toilet, but it's not supposed to signify, I'm interested in the infrastructures that are built in things such as activist camps, autonomous social centres, as a form of prefigurative politics, where certain activist groups have tried to say, right, we need to try and prefigure what infrastructures that are built outside of a capitalist framework might look like. And some of the most famous examples of this have been experiments with building alternative compost toilets and sewage systems and things in protest camps. But obviously I'm more interested in food production, consumption, and how that's been done on a small scale. The second example is free food giveaways, where instead of giving out pamphlets, this is a food giver in Nottingham that I helped to facilitate, and we set up 10 stalls around Nottingham in sites, really busy shopping sites, often outside fast food restaurants, and just use taste as a way of encouraging people to enter into dialogue about what we're doing. Obviously you're giving away free food, and that's a surprise, so that challenges the commercial logic of the space. And we were also challenging the way that Nottingham Council had sort of systematically made it difficult for community groups to use public space. So through these performances we were trying to draw together, not just promote a vegan agenda, but trying to draw attention to lots of different issues through using taste. And the final example, and the one that I find most difficult because I think it doesn't quite as clearly draw issues together in the way that I'd like, is food skill shares. And skill shares kind of related to the giveaways, because often we used to give out pamphlets at the giveaways and invite people to skill shares, so that there's no point in giving vegan food out and then people not being knowing how to make it, on it's not a very sustainable thing in and of itself. So we gave out cheap recipes, and then here are some images from some food workshops where we did kind of cheap veggie burgers. So we're sort of trying to open dialogue with people in this space and sort of think about, okay, how can we make food that's not sort of super expensive, kind of organic vegan food, but how can you use like a tin of kidney beans and some basic veg to make something that's healthy? And but also, why is it so difficult to do that? So it was a sort of questioning activity rather than sort of imposing a set, or it's supposed to be a questioning activity rather than just sort of imposing a set of activist values as the way things should be. Now, the reason I've touched on these examples is because I think they challenge certain dismissals of animal activism that have kind of come up in a few places in animal studies, particularly practices such as veganism, that tend to get represented as very totalising or dogmatic. And I think social movement studies, which is a sort of discipline that just studies how social movements do things, offers some quite nice ways of understanding this form of activism that can maybe sort of shed light on what its potentials are. Now, the first thing I think is interesting is trying to understand this form of activism in the sense of being part of a broader repertoire of different protest tactics. So if we think about, say, food skill shares, in and of themselves, they're not necessarily going to be transformative, but they're not ever taking place in and of themselves. They happen in conjunction with a number of other practices, from the distribution of pamphlets, from sort of more conventional lobbying activities. And I think often unfairly, certain sort of vectors of activism get focused on in and of themselves without understanding the role of these broader ecologies of particular practices. And particular communicative strategies. There's an awareness that different audiences need to be engaged with in different ways, etc. And I think that sometimes kind of blanket judgments get labelled at groups who might be using rights for a strategic purpose in one context, and then having more critical discussions that use context more reflexively in a different context. Social movement studies also constantly stresses the messiness of activism, so it's very experimental. If you're trying to open spaces to have dialogue, there's always the chance of people saying, well, actually, you have misrepresented me, or people saying, well, actually, you're showing me how to make a kind of kidney bean burger, actually, that's not very helpful, or, it's trying to sort of reflect on constantly how you can do things differently. And so I think sometimes, again, sort of snapshots are taken of particular forms of activism, and it's treated as this kind of static moment that kind of speaks for all types of animal activism. and doesn't really take into account the sort of reflexivity that happens in practice. And the final thing I just wanted to touch on that often gets stressed is the mundane barriers that constantly face people when they're trying to engage in awareness raising or food activism or any types of activism that might make it difficult to articulate maybe more complex accounts of animal issues. More complex forms of activism might be due to a lack of resources. It might be due to the difficulties of communicating with particular types of publics. And I think these things are all really important to take into account in order to sort of try to, I suppose, give activism credit and also to learn, I suppose, I think theory can kind of learn from practice as well. Thank you.